Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the March 3rd, 2009 Carrboro Board of Aldermen meeting. I would like to, I'm beginning the meeting from the podium because I'm going to read a proclamation. I'd like to invite you to come up and join me up here. I issued this proclamation today. Whereas the Orange County Rape Crisis Center assisted 377 survivors of sexual violence and their family members, friends, and loved ones during 2008, and whereas the Orange County Rape Crisis Center works with the county's two school systems and other groups to provide all students with age-appropriate information about sexual assault prevention, reaching 9,774 youths and adults during 2007-08 school year. And whereas the coordination of the Orange County Sexual Assault Response Team is bringing together members of law enforcement, the medical community, the legal system, and other community advocates to improve services for survivors of sexual assault who come forward. And whereas one in five North Carolina women have been sexually assaulted at some point in their lives. And whereas in the United States, rape is the most costly crime to its survivors, totaling at $127 billion a year, considering factors such as medical costs, lost earnings, pain, suffering, and lost quality of life. And whereas in the United States, 1 in 6 women and 1 in 33 men have experienced a completed or attempted rape at some time in their life. And whereas there are 5,915 sex offenders and sexual predators registered as living in North Carolina. And whereas the blaming of the victim continues to be an enormous problem in instances of rape and sexual assault, and whereas the Orange County Rape Crisis Center, a nonprofit volunteer agency which has been serving this community since 1974, is working with others in the community to stop sexual violence and its impact through support, education, and advocacy, now therefore be it resolved that I, Mark Chilton, the mayor of Carrboro, North Carolina, do hereby proclaim the month of April 2009 as Sexual Assault Awareness Month, and I encourage all citizens to speak out against sexual violence and to support their local community's efforts to prevent and respond to these appalling crimes.
My name is Christina Reardon, and I'm the Executive Director of the Orange County Rape Crisis Center, and I just want to thank the Town Council for your willingness to declare April Sexual Assault Awareness Month. The Rape Crisis Center has been in the community for the last 35 years, and the town of Carrboro has been a generous supporter of ours. And you know, sexual violence is one of those crimes that really has a lot of silence still surrounding it. And so your willingness to kind of come forward and make such a public statement is really inspiring, and I want to thank you all for that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for all your work.
Thank you. Okay. Is Chris DeFilippo here? Come on up, Chris, if you would. Chris has recently been appointed to the Economic Sustainability Commission, and he is about to be charged. Look out. Stand right in front of her, right there.
I will charge you. Okay. Mayor Chilton.
Yes, ma'am.
Is there someone else on the...
I don't believe David Jesse is here.
Oh, all right.
I don't think so.
No.
Okay. This is a lot of reading to do. Okay.
Yeah.
As a member of the Economic Sustainability Commission, I will evaluate commercial growth, developments, and redevelopment to ensure projects correspond with the town's sustainability goals and the triple bottom line sustainability principles. Do no harm to the environment and protect natural resources. Adhere to the principles of social justice and equity in economic and community development efforts. Return strong stakeholders' value. Promote the development and expansion of diverse job opportunities, providing for economic opportunity and mobility. Administer the revolving loan fund. Work closely with the town manager or his designee for dealing with sustainability issues. Make studies and recommend to the board plans, goals, and objectives relating to the growth, development, and redevelopment of the town. Recommend to the board site-specific plans for the commercial development of various lots within the town, showing recommended types of development for these specific lots. recommend to the board plans for the improvement of access to and circulation within the town by motorists, including parking, public transportation users, bicyclists, and pedestrians. Upon request of the Board of Adjustment or Board of Aldermen, make recommendations to the respective board on requests for special or conditional use permits or land use ordinance text or zoning map changes. Perform any other duties assigned by the board. Having heard the duties of an Economic Sustainability Commission member of the town of Carrboro, I, Chris DeFilippo, agree to perform the aforementioned duties of an Economic Sustainability Commission member, of which I am about to enter according to my best skill and ability. And if you would please sign here, I will help.
Sounds simple enough. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Chris.
Shake your hand.
Is Matthew Arnsberger here?
Can we get Chris to come?
Chris, come here.
Yeah, come on.
We're going to shake your hand.
You have to shake our hand.
We have to shake our hand. We have a tradition. I don't know what the rest of them are saying about it. We have a tradition.
Thank you.
Look
forward to working with you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks
for joining us. Ian's got a joy buzzer. All right. It's Matthew Arnsberger here. Okay. And Diana Tetens or Tetens, are you here?
Tetens.
No. Okay. If you'll just stand right there, Matthew.
Charge of Environmental Advisory Board. Member, the Environmental Advisory Board, I will, as a member, advise the Board of Aldermen on policies, ordinances, and administrative procedures regarding environmental protection and the conservation of natural resources. The areas of review for the EAB include new development, solid waste, air quality, stormwater management, energy conservation, solar energy, groundwater, natural resources, and other areas. Suggest to developers ways to utilize energy-efficient designed techniques such as daylighting, siding, solar exterior lights, and other solar energy techniques as they become economically viable. This input from the EAB is to come at the request of the Board of Aldermen or as part of a concept review procedure. Adopt a set of guidelines or goals for the EAB and review these goals periodically to determine if they're being obtained. Take any other action authorized by the Board of Aldermen. Having heard the duties, I, Matthew Arnsberger, agree to perform the aforementioned duties of an Environmental Advisory Board member, of which I am about to enter according to my best skill and ability.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you,
guys.
Thank you. Okay. Now, before we begin the consent or turn to the consent agenda, I asked one of our town attorneys. Our second string town attorney, no offense, T.C. Morphis, to join us this evening. T.C. Works for the Bro Law Firm with Mike Bro, and Bob Horning, for that matter, too. And T.C. has represented us in, actually, I think, in a number of different capacities in the past, but most recently in a lawsuit between the town of Carrboro and Marilyn Kelly. Regarding the Peppermint Spring Farm, and some of you may have who are watching at home or here in the audience may have read about some press attention to this particular case, and I asked TC to be here tonight and to brief the Board of Aldermen in short about what has happened in this case, why there ever was a lawsuit between the town and Ms. Kelly. And I want to point out that although we normally discuss litigation matters in closed session behind closed doors, which we're allowed to under North Carolina law, we've chosen not to tonight, or I'm suggesting that we not do so tonight, because I want all of the facts to be laid on the table and for more than simply one side of this story to be heard by the public. So, TC, if you could provide us with a recap, relatively short, hopefully, recap of where we are and how we got here in this case.
Sure. Before I get started, I'd sent you all a memo about a week or two ago. Does anybody need a copy of that, or are you all?
If you have
copies,
you can pass them out.
And Mayor Chilton, I'm always happy to play second string. While those are getting passed down, I'll give you just the short history, and I'm happy to answer any questions you all have. So from the town's perspective, this really started in about October of 2006. At that point, we got a complaint from a former tenant that complaining about an apartment in Ms. Keeley's barn on her farm, Peppermint Springs Farm, saying it wasn't adequate. And as I mentioned in the memo, we don't do landlord-tenant mediation as part of the town. But we do, of course, do zoning enforcement. Ooh, sorry, didn't mean to do that. I'll keep my hands away from the podium. We do zoning enforcement, and the town staff determined that this was a second living unit with or dwelling unit within a single lot within the watershed residential zoning district, which under our ordinance is not permitted. As you all know, you can only have one dwelling unit per lot. So we did what we do in any zoning enforcement action. We sent Ms. Keeley a letter. Mike Bro in January of 2007 met with Ms. Keeley and discussed the matter with her. Long story short, we really didn't get any progress to resolving the issue. And at that point, we were looking at having her take the apartment out and make it a barn that would comply again with our land use ordinance. I filed suit.
If I could ask you for a few more details, when was this second dwelling unit on the lot built?
That's a good question. And what Ms. Keeley has said since the very beginning is that it was built at the same time her barn was built. The barn was built in 1997, and this is an important point. Mike Canova is here tonight if you have specific questions about building inspection. It was built with the town's full knowledge, the barn was. She or her contractors applied for building permits for plumbing and electrical and perhaps one other building permit related to the construction of the barn. But we never knew at that time that she intended to build an apartment within the barn. And and I mentioned this in the memorandum to you all. We received a sketch plan that showed something labeled tack room, supplies, wash tub area, and that essentially became the apartment. And I know she and in speaking with Mr. Way, who wrote the editorial for the Herald, had mentioned there were lots of photographs and that sort of thing. One of the things I pointed out in our in my memorandum is that those were never submitted into evidence in the lawsuit we brought. And it's a long way of saying I couldn't tell you exactly when the apartment was completed and when people started living in there, but she has said it was built about the time the barn was built. From our perspective, we were always looking at the barn as a barn. And when we were inspecting plumbing and electrical, we were inspecting it for a utility sink and for the electrical that would serve a workshop or tack room. So,
in the you said the zoning of the property is watershed residential.
Correct.
And when approximately did we adopt the watershed residential zoning district?
I'm going to guess the early 90s, Mike.
Around 1990.
But like 7 years,
spring of
roughly 7 years right. Before this barn and apartment were built.
That's right. Backing up, this property has been in the town's ETJ since at least the early 60s and maybe the late 50s. So then the watershed residential ordinance is adopted in around 1990. Barn is built in 97. Again, we didn't know the apartment existed. And so in 2006, we find out about it, and we go through our zoning violation process, which resulted in us filing suit in Orange County District Court. In March of 2008, we had a summary judgment hearing in front of Judge Beverly Scarlett, and she ruled that there were no material facts in question, which means that there, from her perspective, there wasn't any question about what the town knew and didn't know. That we didn't know that there was an apartment in 1997, and she ruled in the town's favor. And that's where I think things start to get a little complicated in terms of the enforcement. I know there's been some confusion about what the town is requiring and what the town is not. Judge Scarlett ordered that Ms. Keeley needed to bring her apartment or her barn and property into compliance with a land use ordinance And it was initially within 120 days. There's a provision also about 180. For all intents and purposes, 180 days. And there were really two ways she could do that. She could tear the apartment out and make it, again, a single dwelling unit on the lot, or she could try and bring the dwelling unit into compliance with the land use ordinance. But, of course, because it's in the watershed residential district and because this had never been permitted in the first place as an apartment, that was somewhat complicated. Ms. Keeley opted to try and make the apartment a lawful use, and she submitted a subdivision application. Of course, because it's in the watershed residential district, that made it a major subdivision requiring a conditional use permit, and she went through that process. And I know that she was in front of you all in October of last year, and her conditional use permit and subdivision plat were approved. Yes, ma'am.
I'm sorry to interrupt. Remind me again when she bought the property.
I'm not sure. I could go back and look. I know she has told me.
Was it after 1990?
Yes.
I'm going to guess, but I don't know that. I think from what she has told me, she had not had the farm for a long time before she decided to build a barn, but I don't know.
So when she bought the property, mm-hmm. if we presume it was after 1990, okay. and it was zoned watershed residential, she would have known that and known what watershed residential meant when she bought the property and she signed the papers, right? Or she should have known because it was...
That's a good question. I mean, I would think that when she closed on the property, and I'm just guessing here, that she would be presumed to know about the zoning the same way anybody would when they purchase a property.
And the realtor would inform them and...
Again, I don't know.
But it's in the papers that you sign when you buy the property, right?
Well, one thing that we do know is that if the town had known about this apartment, and I mentioned this in my memorandum, that the first thing we would have done, the building inspections would have done, is they would have said, we need to go check with zoning and see if that's permitted. So this wasn't a situation where Mike on his lunch break said, sure, have an apartment.
Right.
Nothing like that ever happened. And that for us shows more that the town really never knew about this in 1997, because we would have said go to planning and zoning. Then zoning would have said you're in the watershed residential, you can't have a second unit. And, you know, by the way, even if you could, you'd have to get proper building permits and a certificate of occupancy for that. And you'd have to pay the Orange County educational fees, impact fee, all of which were in place in 97. And none of that happened. So I don't know what happened at the closing, but from the town's perspective, we certainly would have taken steps to inform Ms. Keeley about what would have been permitted and not had we known about it.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Okay. So she received her CUP and her subdivision plat approval. To date, Ms. Keeley has not recorded either, and I think that is because she is objecting to the position we're taking on state building code requirements, and I don't want to put words in her mouth, but that's my understanding. And the town staff's perspective is that until those documents are recorded, her property has not been properly subdivided, and the CUP, I guess, is not properly effective.
So the town, that we as Board of Aldermen have approved the subdivision of this property.
That's correct.
So it would be two different lots, and there
that's
would
right.
be one dwelling unit on each lot.
That's right.
But she has chosen not to complete, so far at least, not to complete that subdivision process?
That's right. And once she records those documents, and again, Roy or Marty, correct me if I'm wrong, she would have resolved the zoning side of this. But again, because the unit was never permitted in 97, there's the building code side of things and the impact fee. And this is not something that I've ever seen before, and I don't know if the folks in building inspections have seen it either. So we called the Department of Insurance to ask them, what do we do with this structure? I mean, there were some permits issued in 97, but they weren't for an apartment. And, of course, Department of Insurance is the agency that's in charge of the state building code, and they're the guys that we ask when we have questions. And they said, if it was never permitted, then it's as if it never existed, and it has to comply with the current code. And get a CO under those standards, and they were very clear about that. So, you know, it really at that point, we don't have any say in what can and can't be done under the building code. And same thing with the Orange County educational facilities impact fee. I communicated with Orange County planning staff and asked them, what, if anything, does she need to pay? And they said it was never paid, then she'll need to pay the current fee for a single-family residence. And that's the position they've taken, and it's their impact fee. So,
The one question I have is in this article that was in the mm-hmm. in the paper, it says that she initially went along with the subdivision solution until she learned her residential mortgage and farm tax status would have her have to pay $350,000 in back taxes mm-hmm. To make the switch and then incur $58,000 in additional property mm-hmm. taxes thereafter. Can you address that?
That's a good question, and, mm-hmm. and I'm not going to be able to give you a full answer, but I can tell you that from the first time I met Ms. Keeley, which would have been probably in September of 07, the talk about possibly subdividing, we've talked about possibly subdividing the property, and one of the things that gave her pause was this issue about taxation and how that would affect her. I think she has an use value property taxation and how it would affect all those things.
In other words, it's in that program where they tax farms at a lower rate.
That's my understanding. And okay. her concern, and she said this all along, was that, you know, now it would be treated as a residential property. Somewhere along the line, she retained an attorney, Mr. Josh Hansen out of Raleigh. Gotten to know him pretty well and have a lot of regard for him. And he represented her at the summary judgment hearing and was advising her as she went through the subdivision process. And again, I don't want to put words in either Ms. Keeley's or Mr. Hansen's mouths, but they reached a point where they were comfortable with whatever the implications would be from a subdivision of the property. Now, I don't know if it's that she decided that additional money, she'd be willing to pay additional money, or that Orange County told her there wouldn't be any, because, again, that's not something that, you know, we're really privy to. So this statement that she is, I guess, attributed to her in the editorial took me by surprise, mm-hmm. because I know she had raised those concerns like a year ago, but by going through the subdivision process, I thought with advice from her attorney, she was comfortable with the implications from doing that process. So I can't fully address the question.
Mr. Mayor, can I just comment? The article makes two implications. One, that somehow the town has forced her to go through the subdivision process, which is simply completely inaccurate. The town brought that alternative to her attention to as an alternative way of complying with the ordinance. Of course, the simple way of complying with the ordinance would be to do that which is necessary physically so that you don't have the violation in the first place, which mm-hmm. is to get rid of the apartment. I mean, that's a simple and fairly economical solution that, you know, had it never been put in there in the first place, we wouldn't have this problem. You'd easily remove a few facilities in there to make it mm-hmm. clear it's no longer an apartment, and it wouldn't be an apartment, and that would take care of the violation. The town's not forcing her to subdivide her property. Nor does this matter have anything to do with annexations. There's some implication or some suggestion along the way that somehow this is either having something to do with annexation, which it has absolutely nothing to do with. Annexation of the property has never been suggested to her and wouldn't solve the problem in the first place. The other thing, that is some indication that somehow this is interfering with her farm use of the property. I'm not exactly sure what farm use is being made of the property, but whatever that use is, it's permissible in the district. We've never suggested that there's anything improper about the farm use of the property or that it negatively affects that in any way whatsoever. It does not.
So, you know, you stop me if you think I'm wrong, but the way this situation reads to me is that She filed the necessary paperwork to get a building permit and to go about building a barn, mm-hmm. and she labeled one corner of it as a tack room on the application. Mm-hmm. And then sometime after the last inspection that was made by the Carbro Inspections Department, she turned that so-called tack room into an apartment without a certificate of occupancy, without the proper permits from the town of Carrboro, without the right land use designation on the building permit, mm-hmm. And without paying educational impact fee like anybody else would have to do if they built mm-hmm. a house or an additional apartment. Is that right?
I think that's basically right.
And these are all actions that were her choices. She chose to do these things.
Mm-hmm.
And now she finds herself in a difficult position because it's a question of either, you know, possibly having some kind of tax consequences to coming into compliance with the ordinance by subdividing the property, mm-hmm. or on the other hand, foregoing whatever money she invested in the apartment that was built without a permit.
I think that's right. The only other thing I would add, and may have led initially to some confusion about what her building permitting requirements would be if she kept the apartment, where we've been trying to work with her all along. And one of the things we said is, if you tear out the apartment, we understand that you have a bathroom in there, and we could allow that to stay because, you know, bathrooms are in barns sometimes. We'd need a building permit for that. And I gather informally from what I've heard from her attorney that she may have been under the impression that's all she needed to do was get a permit for the bathroom. We never told her that. We said, if you tear out the apartment, this is something different or additional that you can keep. But I think otherwise we've been fairly clear, and I think everything you said is accurate.
And what exactly does tear out the apartment mean? I assume the room doesn't have to be deconstructed,
no.
But somehow whatever makes it an apartment?
That's a good question, and I'm going to ask building inspections folks to correct me if I'm wrong, but basically make it not a habitable dwelling. So you need to not have an area that could serve for cooking. You need to not have an area that's exclusively reserved for sleeping. And, of course, that's a little tricky. I mean, you can sleep kind of anywhere you want. But really, the major things we were looking at were making the kitchen area not operable as a cooking area. And then I know building inspections had said that she should label the area that's currently a bedroom as for storage only, and the idea being that it can't be held out as a bedroom. So there were some things that she'd have to do, but I don't know if it'd be, you know, tearing everything down to the studs.
No, it would not be. It's just a matter of not complying with the definition of a dwelling unit. And we faced this issue before a number of times, not in this exact context, but under circumstances where someone has transformed a portion of the house into a second dwelling, and you know, if it has sleeping, bathroom and kitchen facilities in a separate enclosed area, it's a dwelling unit. If you take remove any one of those three elements, it's not. So it's not especially costly or difficult to render it in such a fashion that simply doesn't meet the definition of a dwelling unit. Let me, while I've got the microphone here, Marty corrected me in one respect. As part of the standard response to a conditional use permit application, apparently the town regularly asks, will the applicant consider annexation? And apparently that boilerplate language was included with her response to her application. But again, there certainly has been no pressure put on her to annex. She chose not to annex, as some people do. Some people choose to annex, some people choose not to annex. There's been no pressure, and it wouldn't have solved. It certainly wasn't a matter of the town saying to her, well, the only way you can resolve your problem is if you get annexed, or that annexation is a requirement to get the conditional use permit. That was never said. But I do stand corrected that at least the word annexation was on the paper, so to speak, as a boilerplate that we send out. Didn't want to leave that misimpression.
Okay.
Excuse me. I think if you're going to be discussing my firm and this situation, that I ought to be given an opportunity to at least present another point of view, one that's a little bit more accurate than what I've been hearing on the television.
You may or may not get that opportunity. You're welcome to have a seat. Hold on.
Thank you.
So at this point, there's still two dwelling units on the lot. It's still one lot, and it's still in violation of the ordinance.
That's correct, to the extent that the CUP and subdivision plat have not been recorded.
Okay. What can we do at this point to bring this case to closure? I don't have any particular interest in any of this subject, except that there was a complaint filed with us that has brought to light a violation of our ordinances,
right.
And you know, I and my fellow aldermen are sworn to uphold the laws of the state of North Carolina and of the town of Carrboro, and we have to enforce our ordinance.
Right.
So what can we do?
Well, you've got several options, and I'll lay them out and then tell you the course that town staff had talked about pursuing. Under Judge Scarlett's order, if the apartment's not brought into compliance with the ordinance within effectively 180 days, we could go back and ask that the order be amended and obtain a judgment for $10,000. We have not done that, and we do not have a judgment against Ms. Keeley at this time because we'd have to go back to the court to get that. And one of the reasons we haven't pursued that is, from our perspective, we're really more focused on there being a public health issue with the apartment. Namely, there is a structure there that does not have a certificate of occupancy. And so that was what we've been focused on. And what we have proposed to do, and I regret that Ms. Keeley has not received a letter yet because I have not drafted it, is give her a certain amount of time to bring the apartment into compliance with the state building code, or we're going to see that the power is turned off. And I've spoken informally with her attorney, Mr. Hansen, about this. And we've advised him that she could have the meter split. Right now there's a single meter that serves the barn and the apartment, and she could have it split so that there would still be electricity going to the barn. But from our view, if there's no electricity going to the apartment, then at least it can't effectively be inhabited. And then at that point, I think we probably would consider the issue, let me phrase this correctly, resolved enough, in as much as there wouldn't be anyone who is living in the apartment, so presumably there wouldn't be a safety and health violation. But Ms. Keeley, at a future point, if she wanted to, could take the steps to get her building permits and certificate of occupancy to then have it as a lawful dwelling unit again. So what we didn't want to do was take the steps of trying to force her to tear out the apartment if there's something less we could do that would still maintain public health and safety. So that's where we're headed right now.
But if she chose to record the subdivision plat, or mm-hmm. she chose to demolish the kitchen area or whatever, or the cooking area within the apartment, then that would
be a third option. If she wanted to, she could still make the apartment not habitable space. Our building inspection staff would have to go out and verify that, but that has always been an option.
That's really the simplest option, but that option has not been.
That part's not under our control.
Well, she's not chosen to do that. Mm-hmm. Now, recording the approved plat or the subdivision, I'm sorry, recording the approved CUP with the subdivision plat does not resolve. It resolves the zoning issue, but does not authorize the property to be used for residential purposes because mm-hmm. of the two matters over which we have no control.
Mm-hmm. State building code.
The state building code, which requires that the property be permitted as a residence, which it never was. When I say the property, I'm referring just to the portion of the barn that would be habitable.
Yeah.
And secondly, that the fee be paid. According to our contract agreement with Orange County, we're not supposed to issue a certificate of occupancy unless the fee has been paid, which it has not.
How much is that fee?
I don't remember.
Currently, it's about $6,000.
For the school impact fee?
Yeah, for a single family dwelling. Or a new single
it was
family.
Lower in 1997.
It was lower in 1997. And that is not
like
our call either.
Then, but.
As TC said, just to emphasize, that is not something that we...
We don't set those fees.
We didn't set those fees, and we have no choice in the matter. We've got a contract with Orange County.
Let me also add, I mean, I specifically asked that question. I asked, should we charge the 97 fee? Should we treat it as an apartment or a multifamily dwelling unit because there are different rates? And the answer we got back was the current rate for a single-family dwelling unit. So that's Orange County's call.
In terms of solving the zoning problem, by potentially recording the conditional use permit and the plat, is that something that's expensive to do?
Not at all.
No.
I mean, it would be maybe,
my experience of plat recording costs, I think, $50.
Right, I was going to say maybe $50 or $75. And that's something we would require before a CO were issued. But that's right.
All right. I have a feeling, I guess at least if I can just express my opinion, I'm not really ready to say exactly how I think we ought to proceed on trying to bring this to some closure. I'm really not interested in imposing additional fines against Ms. Keeley. It seems like she's you know, there's already a lot of money involved in this particular case. So I'm not very enthusiastic about the notion of going to Judge Scarlett and asking for a $10,000 fine to be imposed. And I don't know, when you say about having the power company cut off the meter to the barn, or the portion of the meter that serves the barn, I've been involved in local government for just over 17 years. I've never heard of that before. Is that something that we have the power to do?
That is under the state building code. We are authorized to do that, and it's unusual. Typically, you don't pull the power, and you don't typically do that for an existing building. It's something that happens more, you know, they're in the middle of building the project, and they don't have permits. You pull the power until they get them. But, again, we are looking for a way to, you know, allow the unit to stay there and not force Ms. Keeley to tear it out, but also not make it a health hazard.
In other words, the problem right now is that as long as it remains as it is, it obviously, like any other situation, without the town just sort of watching all the time, doesn't require much when you have a dwelling unit there with power to it to have it be used as a dwelling unit again. And the way that can be avoided is to have a separate. There's two ways it could be avoided. Again, the simple way is to have sufficient facilities, i.e. the kitchen removed, so it doesn't constitute a dwelling unit anymore, in which case that takes care of the violation. That's the simple answer that's been there since day one. And the other alternative would be to say, okay, we would require that the separate meter be created for the portion of the building other than the dwelling unit on a separate meter. Now, right now, you've got one meter for the whole structure, the barn / apartment. It's got one meter. If you had two meters there, one for the barn minus the apartment, and the other for the apartment, but then the meter was turned off for the apartment, then that could not be occupied because there'd be no electricity in it.
Right.
That's a little more complicated solution, perhaps a little more expensive, but it's one that.
Okay, so when you were talking about a split meter situation, you weren't saying, at least as far as we know or understand at this point, there's actually two different meters on the property now. Is that right?
Well,
I mean, one to the barn and one to the house?
Ms. Keeley's here tonight, so she could probably answer that better than I. But as I understand it, there is a meter to the barn and there's a meter to the house. And that's it. What we are saying,
you're not talking about interfering with the meter to her house.
We're not talking about interfering to the meter to her house. And we were trying to because. And I can answer Mike's question about the operation that's on the property. I mean, Ms. Keeley takes care of a number of horses, and I think she may also do some farming, raising hay and things like that. And we were looking for ways to try and keep power going to the structure that, you know, it's support a farming operation. So that's why this whole issue of possibly having the power just to the apartment turned off came up.
Now, when I think I don't know, at some point within the last year, I believe, I met with Ms. Keeley. She called me and asked me to meet with her about the facts of this particular case. And she raised a couple of interesting questions that maybe you or maybe Mike Canova could address. She says, and she showed me these pictures, which apparently she also showed to the editor of the Chapel Hill Herald, these pictures that show plumbing being installed in the building during the construction process. Does that somehow prove that it was known that there would be an apartment there? I mean, that was the claim that was being made to me when these photos were presented.
I can offer a two-part no. One, no, it doesn't, because, again, we knew there was plumbing and electrical going in because that was permitted to support the workshop. The other point, and again, I'm thinking about this as an attorney, there's a doctrine in North Carolina called latches, which, and Mike's going to correct me when I misstate this, but essentially, in the context of zoning, if a town tell someone affirmatively they can do something with their property under the zoning ordinance, and they rely on that to their detriment, the town may be barred in the future from telling them they have to stop, the idea being that they relied in good faith upon this. And Judge Scarlett specifically found that latches didn't apply in this case, meaning that we never gave her an affirmative statement that an apartment was permitted. And so I would say, no, I don't know the pictures show that, and, you know, no, they were never presented as evidence. I mean, the simple answer for a summary judgment hearing is if there's a question of fact, you prove that, there's a question, just a question, then you can have a trial on it. And we never did that.
Okay.
Well, I'm just going to go to that point. Since summary judgment was granted, I guess the defendant really presented no evidence at trial that showed these pictures or a belief that perhaps there was an apartment early on?
Number one, the pictures were never submitted. And number two, Judge Scarlett found as a matter of, well, she found that it was an uncontested material fact that the town staff were never affirmatively told Ms. Keeley that an apartment would be permitted on the property.
I don't know. I'm not any kind of expert. I don't know how familiar you are with horses or keeping horses. But
very
do people? Do people? I mean, people wash horses, don't they?
As far as I know, yes.
They wash them down. It's also possible to get hot and sweaty after taking a horse out for a ride.
Mm-hmm.
So I mean, there could be a number of reasons, could there not, why plumbing would be installed in a barn,
well,
a horse barn?
Well, more to that, I mean. She, and actually included this, she had a plumber who submitted a proposal for a wash, wash pit. It was a flat wall-hung utility sink, and there was going to be a hot water heater for hot and cold water. So, I mean, we knew that that was going to go into the area that had been proposed as a tack room. And
for that matter, a bathroom is not unusual in a barn, for that matter, in that
that's
a bathroom
right.
would not have alerted them that this was going to be an apartment. It requires a bathroom facilities, bedroom facilities, and a kitchen facility.
Well, but let me qualify that. I mean, we never had a bathroom.
No, I understand that. I'm not suggesting that it was labeled as a bathroom. It was not. But I'm just saying that even if it were.
That's correct.
Even if it were shown as a bathroom on the plans, which it was not, that wouldn't qualify. That wouldn't leap out and say, well, that's a dwelling. Because you can have, just like in a house, you've got multiple bathrooms in a house, that which is fine. That doesn't create two dwelling units. But if you close it off and put a bedroom, separate bedroom in it, and separate kitchen facilities, then you've got a separate dwelling unit.
Mike Canova, could you come up for just a second to the podium? I'm sorry, Alderman, to belabor this point, but I think we really need to get down to what the actual facts of the matter are. Mike, do you recall that a couple of years ago, over at my house, my wife and I built a preschool on our property.
Yes, sir.
Separate building that's on our property. Now, and your department inspected that building as we were building it.
Yes.
We included in. Do you recall that we included plumbing in the building?
Yes, sir.
And naturally so. Wouldn't you think? I mean, we included a bathroom, and we also included a sink. For hand washing, that type of thing.
It's been a number of years, but yes.
I mean that's does the fact that I mean did that somehow raise the question in your mind about whether it was going to be secretly I was building an apartment that I hadn't told you about?
No, not at the time, no sir.
Okay, and various accessory buildings get built around Carver all the time.
Little offices with bathrooms, you know.
Okay, and Mike, one of the other issues that was raised with me when I met with Ms. Keeley within the last year or so, about a year ago, I believe, was the fact that in fact there are probably quite a few properties around town where people have similarly built illegal apartments. Could you just comment on
we
that?
We took the list that was provided, and the three inspectors went out in the field, and we did find some and caught several of them that had apartments in them. Some were grandfathered in. Some buildings were torn down.
When you say grandfathered in, what does that mean?
Well, they were allowed to be there just
Because they were built before the zoning ordinance.
Right, or in Harmony Farms, that was, you know, destroyed. Legends is out there, Wheatley's building out there. And there were some other ones that were iffy. You know, we didn't know if it was a shop, was an apartment, was it abandoned. So we did investigate the list.
To your way of thinking, does the fact that there may be someone somewhere in town who has an illegal apartment mean that other people should be able to have an illegal apartment?
No, we try to, on a complaint basis, pursue each of these individuals and make sure, visit, knock on their door, and we ask them, we go to the door if there's on several occasions.
Okay, so when you say on a complaint basis, you're saying that you investigate situations like that when there is a complaint.
Yes, yes.
And so why did you ever begin this process with Ms. Killian?
There was a lady, a tenant, that called me, and I don't recall her name, I'm sorry, that contacted me and James, and that's how this started.
Why did she contact you? I mean, what did she contact you about?
She was moving out of the apartment, and she had some issues of building inspections issues, and I don't recall them right now. It's been several years since I talked with the lady.
She had a complaint about the condition of the
condition
apartment?
Condition of the space. Talked to James about some zoning, conditions of zoning as well. So she contacted both of us.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thanks.
You're welcome. Anybody else have any other questions?
Okay. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
TC, we're probably, I think, as a board, going to need a little bit of time to contemplate on what we want to do with this particular situation, and we'll try to get back to you relatively shortly with some direction on how to move forward on this case.
All right.
Does anybody have anything else?
Yes, ma'am. I would just like to thank you for the very, very clear way that you've laid this out, both this evening and in your memo. And I hope the memo is available to the press and the public. It's a really nice, very clear. It's the first time that I have felt that I really have a handle on what's happened. So thank you for that.
Well, thank you, Alderman Gist. And certainly it's public record, so I'm happy to make it available.
Ms. Killey has requested to speak to the board about this matter, and I guess I would defer to the board about whether we're open to receiving some comments about it or not. I think the appropriate next step is for Ms. Killey and her attorney to speak with TC Morphus about how to come into compliance with the ordinance.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
I agree.
I have confidence in TC. You know, he's been handling those communications over the last year, and I think, you know, he can continue to do so if he needs our help or if we sense that something's going awry, which it's not, you know, then we could take some further steps.
Okay.
I did have one other thing I want to mention before we move on.
Mr. Coleman, go ahead.
Which is, I was concerned in TC's memo and also in the Herald editorial that there was some incorrect information given to the Herald by a planning board member. And I'm bringing this up not that, I mean, any one of us can make a mistake in talking to the press at any time. But what it brought to mind for me is that, you know, we all talk to the press all the time and have a fair amount of experience with it. Advisory board members do not, and then maybe those of us who are liaisons, that it would be worthwhile to take a few minutes some meeting and talk about, you know, what happens if you get a call from the press. You know, you don't have to answer them right away. You can call staff and make sure you have all the facts. And, you know, of course, not with any sense that anyone shouldn't give their own opinion at any time, but just I think, you know, that I guess I would hope that responsibly advisory board members would want to be well informed about the facts when talking to the press, and that maybe we could just give some, I guess,
share some thoughts about that.
Yeah. So anyway, I just wanted to lay that out for all of you to consider.
Okay. Thanks, Sam. All right. I think
Ms. Keeley, we heard your request to be heard, but I think this was scheduled. We did this as an opportunity to have a conversation with our attorney, and we've done that, and we're going to move on with our agenda. Madam Manager, item the consent agenda, please.
So there are five items on.
Ma'am, you are out of order. Ms. Keeley, you are out of order.
Sir.
I have the lawful authority to keep this meeting moving along.
So, but you know that this was a ruse. This was nothing but a charade to deceive the people of the town of Carrboro. You know that. I hope you can sleep well tonight, but everything you've heard with me.
Ms. Keeley, you are the person who has deceived the people of Carrboro and cheated the taxpayers
Sir,
of Orange County.
Sir, that you held this meeting without letting my attorney know or me know is another example of the spinelessness that you exhibited. And we spoke 2 years ago on February 4th, at which point you said to me at the end of an hour-long meeting, why you, why now? There are illegal
No, I did not say that.
Town of Carver,
I did not say that.
Jurisdiction as well as illegal
All right. You're out of order.
I am understanding I am out of order, sir, and
ma'am,
so
I'm going to ask you.
You
to, no, I am in
I'm
order.
Sorry.
You need to leave this room right now.
I am leaving. I'd be happy to, and I hope none of you believe a word that you heard tonight.
And there goes the reporter. Too.
I paid school impact fees when I built my house. Did you, Jackie?
I certainly did.
Madam Manager.
Okay, there are five items on the consent agenda. The first one is approval of minutes of previous meeting, February 2nd, 10th, and 17th of 2009.
Yeah.
Item number two, it's a request to approve Greenway Commission letter to the University of North Carolina Chapel Hill. Item number three, a resolution calling upon President Obama to issue an executive order that would prohibit discrimination in federally assisted housing on the basis of sexual orientation, gender identity, or gender expression. Item number four is Chapel Hill request for in-kind use of the Century Center on March 28, 2009. And the last item is the request to set a public hearing on the conditional use permit for an arbor at Winmore.
I'll move adoption, but I had emailed some changes on the minutes for February 10th.
And they are duly noted, I think, on your table up there.
Okay, great.
Second.
Okay, it's been moved and seconded for the consent agenda with the minute corrections. All those in favor signify by saying
aye. Aye.
All those opposed? Matter passed unanimously. Yes, ma'am, go ahead.
When we have the public hearing for Winmore, could someone at that particular time when they're making their presentation bring forth to the board the percentage of commercial that exists there? Or if there's any contemplation that other than the daycare center, is that going to be the breadth of the commercial? You may want to tell the developer that's a question that I'm going to be asking.
Okay.
Good idea.
Thank you. I neglected to ask for people who are interested in making a request from the floor. Is there anyone who wanted to petition the board? If you would come up and... I know you've been waiting a while. I apologize, but perhaps you could do us the favor of keeping it concise.
This is Carver. Has controversy ever happened here? Hi there. Alexi, happy birthday, Carver. It's true. Carver celebrates its, or, you know, de facto celebrates its 98th birthday today, March 3rd, 1911. When the area, the west end of Chapel Hill, that was just, you know, a mile from the Chapel Hill post office, was designated, well, was actually chartered by the state to become Venable, named for Francis P. Venable, then the president of the university. A couple years later, in 1913, we changed our name to Carver, honoring Chapel Hill native and Durham industrialist and philanthropist James Julius Shakespeare Carr. He bought Thomas Boyd's Alberta Mill in 1909 and then changed the name to Durham Hosiery Mills number four. And actually, I've gotten copies of both these charters from Sarah here on file of the town that were chartered by the state. I'm Richard Taylor from Orange County, and I probably used to be a resident of Carrboro. I still feel I'm an ex officio member of the town. I ran the camera here for 6 years for the cable TV in the 90s, covered Carrboro for WCHL News. I was on the Pierce Commission for 10 years and a charter member of the original Fetterly Music, now Carrboro Music Festival Committee, and the Carrboro Day Organizing Committee. Now, along with Catherine Devine, who I'm sure most of you know well, couldn't be here tonight, we're working on a book chronicling the history of Carrboro. I figure I've got 2 years to finish that. In the past 100 years, Carrboro has evolved from a railroad mill town to a UNC bedroom community to the parish of the Piedmont and beyond. We are now a thriving arts and music mecca. We were recently named one of America's top 100 art towns, and we're known for our festivals and celebrations of community. Plus the Art Center and the Cat's Cradle are icons. They're jewels in our crown here. So we have a brilliant downtown business community, and it's they have just put together this Walk Carrboro brochure that tells people come to here, I'll walk around and check out all our neat shops and businesses and restaurants. And, you know, just try that in Chapel Hill. The people who live, work, and shop here are obsessive about Carrboro, about this place, just as much as the mill workers and tradesmen who toiled here a century ago. A couple weeks ago, Catherine boasted how cool Carrboro was on WCHL's commentaries, and I'm sure we all feel the same way. Now we're even the envy of Chapel Hill with the Carrboro Music Festival and some of our other events. The Weaver Street Market is our front lawn. They just celebrated their 20th year in operation after getting a loan from the Carrboro Revolving Loan Fund, which has helped so many businesses here start and thrive. So to celebrate our first 100 years, we'd like the blessing, support, and oversight from the Board of Aldermen and the town staff to allow the passionate Carborians and Carboritos to establish yet another citizen volunteer committee, the Carrboro Centennial Commission, kind of a group like helped get the Century Center going a few years ago. And I feel we've got a couple of years to pull this off, and hopefully we would use March 3rd, 1911, the date that's on the town seal behind you there, not May 11th, 1913, when Venable became Carrboro, because that was more like just a technicality. but whatever you'd like to do in that. So I'm here to ask your permission and blessing from the Board of Aldermen to allow a group of citizens, probably the usual suspects, to set and establish the Carrboro Centennial Commission so we can dutifully and joyously celebrate our first 100 years.
So moved, and I'd like to join the group.
Mm-hmm. Let me suggest that we refer this to the staff and just ask them to bring us a resolution that'll kind of formally take that action. I know you and Catherine are not the only people who've noticed that we're only about 2 years away from our 100th birthday, and there are a number of other people that I've actually talked to a little bit about trying to do some planning around this. So I think it's fantastic that you've brought this particular proposal forward, and we'll take some formal action to constitute some type of committee or something along those lines at a meeting shortly upcoming, if that suits
cool.
the board.
That's fine. All right. Just contact Richard Ellington if you have
a
contact.
Just as a reminder, I hear sort of two things that may be a little different. One is to sort of bless and endorse a private committee formed by the committee members themselves and sort of a go-get-em kind of resolution, and the other is to establish a town committee, which then brings into the open meetings law and other matters. So, and I'm not real sure.
God help you.
Which of those you're?
Well, I think that's part of the kind of reason that I say. But let's refer this to staff, and we'll get a
okay.
a little short report back from the staff to so that we can be clear about exactly what we might do. But I know you need to talk to Dave Otto too. He's very interested in this.
Okay.
Right.
So that would imply a conversation between someone and staff and Richard and Catherine.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. And Richard, could you give your phone number to Sharman so staff can get in touch with you? Because in my experience, you can be hard to find sometimes.
Yeah.
So can you.
Indeed.
I'm sure other people have been thinking about this. It's not, you know, a secret.
No, absolutely.
The first person to think about this, because today happens to fall on the 3rd, and it's our 98th birthday. I thought it was apropos to come here.
It's
and
perfect time to ask.
It really was.
Thank you.
And sorry Catherine couldn't be here tonight, but she's a little sick after, you know, recovering from cancer, but she's on board with this, and I'm sure there'll be a large number of people who are working on that. And hopefully in a couple of years we'll have a book out.
There you go.
Great.
Right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Right.
Thank you for your work.
Good to see you.
Okay. Now, item D1, a continuation of a public hearing on an ordinance limiting campaign contributions. Madam Manager, do you have a presentation?
No. My understanding of the discussion amongst the board members.
Okay.
Do your people signed up?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Well, I don't think I have the sign-up list, but the deputy town clerk will be getting that. Yes,
I have a question for the attorney.
Yes.
Does this ordinance include in-kind contributions?
And I guess my question.
Because, for example, if and it doesn't say specifically if you count in-kind contributions, so you could have someone. Let me give you the example I would give. If you decided to not give a contribution and you decided to hold an event at your house, and depending upon how well you were feeling, it could be either what I call, it could be Costco or it could be Southern Seasons. Those are my two examples, because I love Costco. In terms of the amount, you could spend more than $250. And would you be violating the $250 rule if you decided instead of serving ginger ale, you decided to serve, you had a case of wine?
Mm-hmm.
Good wine.
Or even not very good wine.
Or not good wine, but expensive wine. You hope that if it cost you a lot of money, it would be good.
Right.
Or $2. I was going to suggest that in subsection A, where it says, contribute any money or make any other contribution, that instead of make any other contribution, it should say in-kind contribution to cover that, so that that's explicit.
But I guess then the question is that, this is like an election law question, and I don't practice election law.
Neither do I.
So that's the only question I have, is somebody
could
violate.
It's a very good question, and it probably needs to be clarified that and it could be clarified one way or the other. But obviously, when you get, and I did have occasion today to go back and sort of prompted by some editorial comments, is both that either that this is clearly constitutional or it's clearly not constitutional or whatever. Look at some case law, and there are some cases that deal with ordinances that do make it clear that it applies both to contributions that are monetary or in-kind contributions, and we could do that clarification. I guess one of the difficulties or the issues that arises with the in-kind contributions is how do you monitor that? In other words,
yeah,
the Board of Elections monitor. You're required to report it.
I don't practice in this area either, mm-hmm. except that I do run campaigns from time to time. And my understanding is that we do have to report in-kind. I mean, okay. in-kind right. contributions are treated just like cash in terms of how it's okay. reported.
So I don't run campaigns and don't practice in this area, so if there's a fairly common understanding or a definition somewhere of what in-kind contribution is, then we probably ought to make it clear that we ought to use probably that terminology, in-kind contribution, rather than any other contribution, because that is ambiguous, I admit.
Right. I think that would be a good change. Jackie and then Lydia.
I understand if it has to do with cases of wine that somebody's buying to give you a neighborhood party. I get that. That's money that they've spent. That's a campaign expense. And I always count that as a campaign expense. However, in-kind can be such a broad, far-reaching term, you know. If I have a friend that goes and canvasses a neighborhood for me for a Sunday afternoon, is that an in-kind contribution?
Are you paying
only if they're a professional canvasser?
Yeah, and if you're paying them. I think if they're not paying you, that's not, I don't think the First Amendment contemplates that that's an in-kind contribution.
Okay, so as long as that's clear, that people helping you, because I know in other instances, in-kind can be volunteer help, and yeah. I just wouldn't want 10 years from now for some unscrupulous politician to say, well, so-and-so had 50 people out working for her, and that's, you know, and they all went beyond the, you know.
Valued at $4,000.
It could be twisted.
Yeah. Well, I guess what I would say about that is, you know, the same issue exists with whatever the, I mean, no, this proposed rule, which would cap the contributions at $250, is, I mean, there already is such a law. It's just for the entire state. It's
right.
just that the cap is much higher. So I guess point being, you know, you can think of some interesting questions or issues about this, but all the same questions or issues kind of exist about the existing cap. Do you see what I mean?
Okay, then I'll stop worrying about
well,
it.
Well, yeah, so I think the answer is because it's never been viewed that way before, I don't see why it would start being viewed that way now.
So now I brought it up and put it in somebody's head.
Well, good that you did, because now we have some good legislative history making it clear that that is not
that's
our
right.
intention.
Okay.
Correct.
Okay, I'm sorry, Lydia, you had a question.
Right, and I, Jackie, I'm glad you brought that up because I did a little research on this today also, and I do think there is a distinction between campaign expenses made on behalf of someone else and strict volunteer work where you're knocking on doors or stuffing envelopes or whatever, unless you're a paid consultant. But I'm going to throw another question in, as I do with almost everything we do. The provisions of this section do not apply to contributions made by a candidate or a candidate's spouse, parents, brothers, or sisters. Want to see if we can insert partner. And
domestic partner.
Domestic partner, right. Because, I know that the outer exemption of this is some figure like, I don't know, 4,000 or something that, and it does pertain strictly to these specific categories. But I think here in Carrboro, we can certainly, for purposes of this ordinance, exempt a candidate's partner, just like we exempt a candidate's spouse.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Do you have any comment on that?
I wish I had the exact charter amendment here. I don't think that creates a problem, but it seems to me that this language.
Do you have it there?
Yeah.
We have it here.
You have the charter?
Oh,
you
have it. It's always prepared.
Excellent.
Lawyers.
Give me just a moment then.
Okay, we'll go on with our conversation for a minute while he reads that. Did anybody else have any? Well, actually, you know what? Jennifer McMillan has signed up to speak and has been waiting ever so patiently and learned more about Peppermint Spring Farm than she ever wanted to know.
I guess Francis had to leave, yeah.
Francis Shetley was signed up, but apparently had to go. Yeah. Anita, could you look out in the hall and just see whether Francis is still here? Thank you.
I'm just here to speak in support of this resolution. I think that participatory democracy is a good democracy, and I think that if you have a small cap, you will have more people involved. Carver is a small town, and I think that things get done by the grassroots, and this is a way to ensure that things continue to happen that way, and I would encourage all of you to pass this, and I'll stop there because you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jennifer.
Thanks, Jennifer.
All right. Any other issues, questions, or comments on this? Yes, ma'am.
I really, really, the more I think about this, the more I enthusiastically support it because I think we've seen some things happen in neighboring counties where big money has come in order to influence elections in a way that's really against the best interest of the grassroots and the community. So I think this is really good. It's very timely, and I'm glad we're doing it.
I think that one of the most important aspects of this is that it keeps overall campaign costs down. And I think folks don't necessarily look at it that way, but to me that's really important because when you neutralize the costs, then you have everyone on a more level playing field, and then the entire campaign season doesn't get out of hand.
Exactly.
So.
Yes.
I know there was an article in the Herald today kind of talking about this proposal, and it made reference to a United States Supreme Court case, Randall versus Sorrell, a Vermont case. And the headline in the Herald today said, Carrero Plan has legal flaw, and kind of insinuating that without a doubt, this ordinance is unconstitutional, or this what we're trying to pass is unconstitutional. And a closer reading of that case, it's a very complicated case. I'm not going to go into it right now, but it was a 6-3 opinion with a plurality, which means there is no – it's a very fragmented case with a lot of different guidelines on when a contribution threshold may or may not be considered improper. And in this particular case in Vermont, their cycle or their limitation, for example, was for statewide offices a limit of anywhere from 200 to 400 for a two-year cycle for statewide offices. And I think that in a municipality such as ours, where we're where we have a threshold of $250 for a municipality, and there were a lot of other things they went into in this case also, like, for example, the effect it had on local political parties' inability to now to give money to candidates in that state, and that doesn't really affect us because we're not running in partisan, you know, in different parties. So anyway, I just wanted to point out to anyone who read that editorial or anyone who had some concern about that that just like many of these cases, there are different ways to look at it, and it was a 75-page case that had a lot of reasoning in it that wasn't explained in the editorial.
Yes, ma'am.
I think it's timely because right now the Supreme Court heard today a case involving, in West Virginia, a judicial race where somebody spent six figures and got a result that they wanted. And so I'm very much encouraged by limiting the cost of democracy in terms of, you know, we don't want to be a democracy that you get what you pay for.
Yeah, absolutely.
I can
yes.
Answer the question. Now, I don't think there's a problem doing what you suggested. The state law establishes some exceptions, but I don't see any reason that we can't add an additional exception. We couldn't be more strict. We couldn't say that the law even applies to these people, but it seems to me you can also expand that exemption, if you will. And that's number one. And number two, sort of supplementing, I guess, what Lydia said, I took a little look at some case law today, and again, I find it ironic that there's an editorial suggesting it's pretty clearly unconstitutional. We got looking at some of the materials that were on our desk this evening, some people quoting other sources saying, well, it's clearly constitutional, and the answer is, if you read the cases, what you typically find, as I did this afternoon, was I read some cases. I didn't read all the cases. There are a number of cases challenging these things, and what you typically find is the district court goes one way and validates it, and the Court of Appeals reverses them, or vice versa. The district court upholds it, and then the Court of Appeals reverses it. And the Court of Appeals decision is a 2-to-1 decision. You know, I mean, in other words, these are close cases, and no one can tell you, oh, clearly this would pass constitutional muster depending upon which judge hears it at what time. And I mean, you can't do that. There's an argument that any sound attorney could bring that it is, and there's an argument that it is not constitutional. The standard is very mushy, frankly. You know, basically, the U.S. Supreme Court has upheld $1,000 campaign limits. Lesser limits have sometimes been struck down, but they've also been upheld. So what do you do? I mean, you know, it's...
Ultimately, the question is really one of whether this somehow, the restriction would really somehow prevent democracy from playing itself out. And the reality is that, for example... We had a very spirited mayor's race 4 years ago. Both candidates spent, I believe, as I recall, less than $2,000, which with a $250 cap on contributions means that you would need to scare up so much as 8 people to give $250 each to run the type of campaign that we had, run one side of the campaign that we had 4 years ago. You know, I don't believe more than a couple $1,000s have ever been spent on any alderman race, and that I think this leaves ample opportunity for any candidate to make a bid for office if that's what they want to do.
Mm-hmm.
If, you know, I find it really ironic that somebody suggested that it somehow protects incumbents. If anything, I think it potentially ties the hands of incumbents. In general, incumbents have an easier time raising large sums of money if that's what they want to do.
Well, actually, maybe not. I don't think I can hit my family up for any more money after 5 campaigns. So well, I think they'll say
that's why I say in general
that's enough. Yeah, so it probably works against incumbents because people giving you enough money.
Right.
And, you know, I've never spent more than $1,000 on a campaign, yep. And I think this will help bring the cost back down. Yeah.
Wait, right. I know the last couple of races, last race at least, I know a few of us, you know, just I didn't even take contributions over $100.
Right, neither did I. Yeah. Mark, perhaps our late arrival wanted to speak to this item.
Did you, yeah. Is there anybody else who would like to speak on the campaign finance regulation proposal? You stand up at that microphone and introduce yourself.
I am in favor of campaign finance regulations and keeping money out of our politics here as much as possible.
All right. Can you state your name for the record?
Fritzy Ross. I live in Carrboro.
Thanks, Fritz.
Thanks, Fritz.
Thank you.
Okay.
So I'd like to move attachment B with 2 modifications. One is that subsection A, instead of make any other contribution, will say in-kind contribution. And
any,
subsection
I'm sorry,
C.
Any other in-kind contribution? So add the words in-kind after other? Or
no,
or
we'll say any money or in-kind contribution.
Okay, in-kind contribution.
Right.
Okay.
And under subsection C, after spouse, we would insert domestic partner.
Second.
And by domestic partner, do you mean a domestic partner in that is registered in Carrboro? Or
it does. Yeah, it does, you know, have a legal meaning within the town of Carrboro.
Yeah, I remember you and I talked about this one time with regard to something else, and I think we were talking then about health insurance or something, but I guess we need to delineate. Does this mean, what is the definition of domestic partner?
Well,
does it mean technically registered in Carrboro? Does it mean?
It could be. I mean, that certainly is clearly differentiates domestic partner from some other arrangement.
I mean, we could say, you know, domestic partner registered with a government agency or something like that, so
yeah.
That wouldn't it, I mean, you know,
yeah,
if you happen to register in Chapel Hill,
right,
or some,
yeah,
other,
yeah, that's
place
probably
that
the easiest
does it
way to have it done, have it validated, or
yes,
whatever. Yeah.
That, okay.
Would also prevent ambiguity about,
right,
it later on.
So, yeah.
Is,
oh, that person
might
have
a wording change there. Is there a wording change?
Well, I think what I suggested was domestic partner registered with a government agency.
Okay.
Do we need to have a specific
is that so that
on this penalty?
I had an idea.
Because I see that that's blank.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Mike, under 2B.
I have an idea. I think that the blank should be the amount in excess of $250 for that contribution.
So if you took a $500 contribution that wasn't allowed, you would pay a fine.
Yeah, so the fine would be whatever is in excess of $250.
Can we do
it? Does that,
what is a dollar?
Can does that work for you, Mr. Attorney?
The fine would be the amount exceeding the amount of the contribution
in excess of
$250.
Why not?
Okay.
Good with you.
Works for me.
That is the shortest answer I've ever heard.
Good thinking, Jack.
Every now and then.
In the amount of which the contribution exceeds $250. Okay.
Okay.
I have one question,
yes,
just thinking long range when Jackie was talking about 20 years. So 20 years hence, $250, you know, will
could be
like
worth a lot more.
one would think. But
we have to reauthorize this
okay.
every 2 years.
That's I wanted that clarified.
So okay. Yes.
From
so
time to
it'll have to be reviewed.
Right.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
It could be $200.
As long as everyone's aware, that
we are barrels full.
Well, it doesn't just have to be reviewed; it expires. So
right.
It would have
right.
to be reenacted. That I assume the reason that was done was to
pick a new cap.
Pick a new cap.
Yes.
Yes.
Right.
Well, that's
or
not the reason for
review,
time.
Review
but,
it.
But it fits.
That's the reason that
well.
Was imposed.
Let's
put it that way.
Yes.
All right.
All right.
It's what it took to get the legislature to pass it. For those of you who don't know why we're giggling.
The only thing we've ever passed that has to be repassed.
So we good?
Darn near.
All right,
okay. So. Mm-hmm. It's been moved by Dan Coleman
and
seconded by Lydia Lavelle with those amendments. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, the matter passes unanimously. Thanks very much. Okay. Consideration of additional advisory board appointments. Let me also point out that there is a request for a brief, like, five-minute executive session at the end of this meeting.
For matters within attorney-client privilege when you get a chance to.
Okay.
Okay, additional advisory board appointments. What have we got, people?
We've got the planning board.
Yeah.
What is, I guess, I know one of the applicants for the planning board is also an applicant for TAB.
So we can strike him out, because I think he wanted TAB
he
first.
TAB
seemed like
in
it
moment.
In the
he went to
paperwork.
TAB.
Yeah,
first.
He definitely wants TAB.
Okay. Seth Lajunas.
And then there was something in TAB or somewhere that seemed to indicate that Robin Mitchell was had withdrawn as a candidate. Did y'all see that somewhere?
He doesn't think he can do. He doesn't know if he can commit to a full term because he's a graduate student and he has 18 months to go in his program.
So he's pulling out from all applications.
Well, I think the point is that if we would appoint him, it would be with the knowledge that it might only be for a partial term.
Okay.
And Bill Madden had withdrawn his application from the planning board as well.
I saw that, yeah.
Now, Joel, had you said something about Jeff Gisler last time about...
No, actually, I said something about Bob Saunders, and I talked to Bob, and
Bob
he had
Saunders.
Indicated he wanted to be on the arts committee. So.
He does, okay.
I think I probably said something about Jeff because he was also interested in the EAB.
Who was that?
Jeff Gisler.
But EAB's done, right?
Exactly. So I think that frees him up.
So that leaves either David Shoup
or Jeff Gisler.
Right.
Okay.
I know.
Does anybody find this decision compelling? One way or another?
Well, I was just going to point out that I know Matthew submitted this nifty little Google map of where all the current board members mm-hmm. were and where some of the applicants were from.
Which is pretty cool.
Yeah, it was kind of, because it does show that there are quite a few members on the planning board kind of now from the northern from the northern side, it looks like. And I think
the thumbtacks are the applicants.
Yeah, we really need someone from Joel's block.
Yeah, I think the thumbtacks are the applicants, and then the little teardrops are current members.
Right. So you could.
And so you've got Shoup up in, he's the one in Lake Hogan Farms, right?
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I think he's from Lake Hogan
Farms. And you've got Gisler on Pittsburgh.
Well, I don't think we have anyone right in and around, old Pittsburgh.
We basically have people from both vicinities.
Yeah, I don't know if it's geography.
I don't know how be the determining factor.
Okay, well, I'm not. Either candidate looks fine to me, but I don't necessarily.
You could opt to go with Mr. Shoup because he's been here longer, and he, based on the notes, I'm reading the notes, great interest, some knowledge of a mix of town issues, including need for economic development of commercial tax base, walkable community, school districting, connectivity. He's concerned about the interaction of vehicular connectivity with pedestrian bike safety. So,
Yeah, they both look like good applicants.
Right.
I was particularly interested in Jeff Gisler's credentials as an environmental attorney. much of, with the Jordan Lake rules coming up and
no,
some of the...
No, they're never going to be passed.
Well, the fact is, the planning board, when they're looking at the, you know, the documents, that kind of knowledge, I think, is very informative, especially because that doesn't currently exist on that board.
Well...
Yeah, I feel the same way, because, I mean, I think if you look at their actual background, what they do and what they know, I mean, you know, Shoup clearly has done a lot of volunteer work and is well qualified in that sense, but I think Gisler brings an important perspective to the planning board that I think would be helpful in addressing a lot of the issues that come up.
But Mr. Shoup has indicated an interest in being on the board since March 2004.
Yes.
And you know, I just, you know, I'm going to say, at least for the planning board, you do need someone who is, has a little season in Carrboro.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just, I mean, I don't have anything against Mr. Gisler. And
I'll back you on that.
Yeah, I mean, either of these people are going to do great.
Yeah,
I'm
sure. Yeah, I mean, they both, and they both have been to the planning board.
Can I just suggest we just do a straw poll show of hands for, I'm not asking anybody to vote against anyone, but just straw poll of hands in favor of Shoup? Okay. Gisler?
Well, I'd be fine with either.
Yeah, either one is fine, really.
Well, but we have to decide.
We have to vote.
Right. Yeah. Well,
all right, so is there a motion?
You just did a
straw
poll. I move Mr. Shoup.
I second.
All right, Shoup is moved and seconded. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed, matter passed unanimously. Let's jump.
Let's just keep going.
Yeah, let's. All right, TAB, ETJ, we have one seat and one applicant. This is.
Yeah, she hasn't been able to come to a Thursday night meeting.
Mr. Attorney, this is. Are we required by law to have an ETJ seat on the Transportation Advisory Board, or
we are current unless we changed the
not by statute, but
by our own policies or whatever.
Right.
I got you. And the ETJ, as opposed to the annexation area, the ETJ is that all that like purple stuff behind you there.
Let me just get the ordinance so we know.
Okay, well, let's just skip over this while he does that. He looks at that issue.
All right,
I have a concern that my perception is that there are not very many, there are not actually that many people who live in our ETJ at this point. And anyway,
so I'd like to move Seth Lajeunesse for
second.
The in-town
second.
Seat.
For the in-town seat on TAB. All right, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, the matter passed unanimously.
Arts Commission.
There are five seats.
Five seats and five applicants, but we do have to assign them to the various terms.
But maybe not necessarily. I have three that I'd like to nominate.
Okay.
Aaron Hurst for the...
seat that expires in 09?
Yeah, but I think those dates are wrong. Bob Saunders for the next one.
210.
And I'm Chris Beecham for 211.
Okay, but there's 209 seats.
Yeah, I think that number's wrong.
Well, but in other words, because it expires January 31st, 2009, that means it has already expired.
Right.
So it expires actually whatever, like 3 years from now.
Okay.
So it's really, the 09 is really the same as.
Is the 12.
Okay.
12.
Okay.
Okay.
If you
I'll
see
second that.
Thank you.
Okay.
So who was nominated for 2012?
2012 would be Chris Beecham.
And?
I'm sorry. And Aaron Hurst.
Okay.
Okay. And then for
2010
would
Bob
be Bob Saunders.
Saunders. Yeah.
Okay. And are you?
I'm just proposing.
Let's vote on that.
I'm just proposing those three.
Is there a second for that motion?
I seconded that motion.
All those in favor, signify by saying
aye.
Aye.
All those opposed.
So what happens to the 2011 ones?
Well, there's one more 2010 and 2011.
We're hoping to get some more applicants and review some more applicants.
Reviewing applications.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So let's just leave that alone for right now.
Thank you.
Of the Appearance Commissioner.
Is there a motion to appoint these two?
I would like to add, unless we've already appointed him because he did ask to be reappointed, I'd like to add to the two that are there, David Markowitz to be reappointed.
I thought he...
No, that's Board of Adjustment.
No, David Markowitz is on the board, is on the Appearance Commission.
Oh, and
I thought the note said that been appointed again.
I thought the note said that he had... Did we appoint him the last, like, a month ago?
It says appointed
to... We can appoint him again just in case.
No, but it says right here, appointed 2/10/09. So that's why I didn't...
Was it to Appearance?
It says Appearance Commission.
Okay. I work with them on that.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that's why I thought...
Yeah, I knew.
I mean, not that I was...
Okay, never mind.
Thought it was...
Yeah.
He was already on there.
So, I mean, you can put it in the motion anyway just to be extra sure.
That's okay.
Okay. So is there a motion to appoint Sarah Andrews and Carrie Goldsmith?
Yes.
So move.
It's been moved and seconded. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, the matter passes unanimously.
Let me just ask, and we already voted on that, but Sarah Andrews is also listed under Rec and Park. And do we know...
Oh, did she prioritize her... Nope.
Well, yeah, what are we doing with Rec and Park?
Let me just suggest that with Recreation and Parks, there's for the in-town seats, there's no offense for the out-of-town seat. For the in-town seat, you know that Doris is the current chair. She'll be going off as chair this year, but she was thinking that her term was expiring next year, and I think it's her desire to stay on. She's involved with some national committees. It's her desire to stay on for at least part of another term, and then she wants to go off.
Okay, in deference to her years of service, I think we should support that.
Sarah Andrews lists Arts Committee as her first choice. Did you all consider her at Arts?
Well, we can add her to the Arts Committee then. I thought
there's a spot.
There is a spot. So I would like to move that Sarah Andrews now be appointed to the Arts Commission.
So instead of Appearance?
For the 2010, one of the 2000.
You're confusing me, Dan. Okay. I thought you were talking Recreation and Parks.
We already voted to appoint Sarah Andrews to the Appearance Commission. Did you want to? Are you proposing?
No, I'm not.
Her?
No, I'm not.
Let's just leave her where she is.
I thought Dan was.
Right, but my point is that
her number one
is Arts, number two Rec and Parks, and then she has some others just X'd. And if her first is Arts, and we need people on Arts, should we in fact have put her there?
No, but we need people on Appearance too. So
right.
Yeah.
We really need people in appearance.
She's already been appointed.
Okay.
Yeah. Why don't we let her let us
if
know?
She doesn't like that, she can say, I'd like to change it.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
So is there a motion to reappoint Doris
Morrell?
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, the matter passed unanimously. And then what are... Oh, so... Okay.
You know, it might be more helpful if people would pick... have the directions they pick your top two. Maybe.
Mr. Attorney, on the ETJ seat.
There is a requirement in the Code of Ordinances, 5 of Chapter 3, that says of the six members of the TAB shall be residents of the town,
and one member shall be a resident of the town's extraterritorial jurisdiction, which, you know, is not the joint planning area, but it's the town's ETJ that's defined by that 1963 statute.
What if we change that?
Yes, you can change that.
What if we change it to, say, ETJ or joint planning area so that it's...
Or why don't we just say maybe a member of the ETJ, which is that language is used elsewhere under one of the other boards.
Certainly do that.
We need to have a meeting about that.
Well, we'd have to schedule. It's a change to the ordinance. We'd have to schedule an item on that.
You would not require a public hearing because this is the TAB. The establishment of the TAB is not done through the land use ordinance. It's done
right
in the town code.
I mean, okay. So well, let me suggest that
need to
then
bring
that
an amendment.
Why don't you? Is there a motion to request that the attorney draft a proposed amendment?
So moved.
Okay. And
it says what? Maybe a member?
Yeah. Okay. May be appointed from ETJ or joint planning.
And I think you'll see that one of the other advice reports has that language.
Okay.
Okay. And then we'll have that. We're not voting on whether we're doing that yet. We're just voting on whether we will consider doing that. So is there a second for Dan's motion?
Yeah, second.
All right. It's been moved and seconded.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed?
Nay.
Matter passes.
I won't discuss
5-1. Yeah.
I want to discuss it first, so that's why I voted no.
That's okay. We will now. We will discuss it.
Yeah, I know, but I want to discuss it before we set a resolution, because sometimes I feel like a resolution is almost like a
foregone.
Yeah.
Well, okay. Are there? I think we're done with this for now. Is that right?
Hopefully.
There are no other motions. Okay. Is there a motion to? Are there any matters from the town manager?
Yep.
Or.
Just a full session for matters within the attorney-client privilege. Short.
I have one matter. Briefly. And we may need to wait till Steve is here to actually discuss this, but I talked with him on the phone last week about the problems of the big public hearings backing up on each other, and suggested that maybe the solution should be that we would change our rules so that staff at its discretion can schedule a public hearing during a regular business meeting. And so I just wanted to raise that with you all, maybe, and, you know, maybe we should just get that on the agenda, something to talk about. I think, you know, what we experienced with Colleton and Claremont, I mean, that's not good for anyone to right. try and do them that right. way. And we need a better approach.
Okay.
So,
yeah, if it prevents people from sitting for hours.
Can we refer that to the staff for a report or a proposal or something?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, I'll move that.
I'll second.
It's been moved and seconded. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed? The matter passes unanimously. Thank you very much. Okay, is there a motion to go into?
There's a motion to go into closed session to discuss attorney. To discuss a legal matter and for attorney-client privilege. Is that close enough?